believe assault is an act, not an adjective. Your safety is not just on the gun, it is the gun. Freedom is a fundamental human right. Welcome to your show, Two-Way Radio with Bill Carnes. Your safety is your responsibility, not the government's, not anybody else's. Be a citizen, not a subject. Better yet, be a listener. Because it's an inalienable right, not a privilege. The Two-Way Radio Show with Bill Carnes is live, right now. Call 1-800-313-9443.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the show. 2 days ago, just outside of Las Vegas, the world's largest shooting range, known as the Clark County Shooting Park, had its grand opening. Kind of interesting, though. I believe that the grand opening was scheduled simply because of the benefit of all of the dignitaries involved, because the park itself won't actually open for anybody to go out there and go shooting for another 3 months. So they opened a quarter early. They did their cool little thing, and you had Wayne LaPierre there, and of course, a lot of local dignitaries. Let me read you the story here. The world's largest and most comprehensive shooting park opened north of Las Vegas. The massive range and support facility cost $60 million to construct. The world's largest and most advanced shooting range officially opened today in Clark County, just north of Las Vegas, with a host of dignitaries. The $60 million Clark County Shooting Park is both large and comprehensive, designed to attract not only locals, but shooting enthusiasts from around the world. Nevada's politicians came out to praise the facility, along with the NRA. Nevada Senator Harry Reid, scumbag, but he actually was quite instrumental in opening this place. He spoke today at the opening ceremony for the Clark County Shooting Park, and Reid was instrumental in securing land for more than $60 million and more than $60 million in funding for the park. Senator Reid had to say had this to say at the opening of the shooting park, quote, "I appreciate the work of all those from Clark County, of sportsmen and sportswomen from across our state, and of local law enforcement officials, and of everyone else who has shared this goal. Nevadans aimed high when they set out to create the largest and most advanced shooting range in the world, but we kept a steady eye on our target." Notice the neat little pun. "And today, with great pride, Nevada has hit the bullseye." Senator Reid's comments were part of a press release in the afternoon. Wayne LaPierre, CEO of the National Rifle Association, and other NRA members also attended the opening. In the same release of the offices of Harry Reid, it quoted Wayne LaPierre as saying, "I am proud to stand shoulder to shoulder with Senator Reid to fight to protect our Second Amendment," LaPierre said. "I can tell you, no one else has been a stronger advocate for responsible gun ownership than him. I am proud to join him today at the world-class facility. We wouldn't be here without vision and hard work." The other dignitaries included shooting park manager Don Turner, who's a good guy, County Manager Virginia Valentine, Commissioner Tom Collins, Senator John Ensign, Representative Shelley Berkeley, Commission Chairman Rory Reid, Senator John Lee, and Governor Gibbons. That was State Senator John Lee. So, there you go. It had its unveiling, but it won't be available for people to go out there and start shooting until late December. We're actually going to be able to go out there and start running courses as of January, and I am involved with the group right now. A very tight-knit, very highly capable group of really nationally recognized instructors that are putting together a group to be able to put courses on out there at that park. There's, you know, several hurdles to overcome. Those are being overcome now. Several are already done. And locked in with understanding Don Turner, the manager out there, who actually came to us from the Ben Avery shooting facility just north of Phoenix, Arizona, a few years ago to get this project going. Looking forward to doing all this come the first of 2010. Stay tuned. There's more to come. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, on 2A Radio.
Rule 1, assume it's loaded. Rule 2, don't point it at anything you're not willing to destroy. Rule 3. Listen to the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes. 1-800-313-9443.
Okay, so we've got a couple of Second Amendment cases that are going to be coming up early in front of the Supreme Court's latest session. Let me read this to you. The Supreme Court will consider two new cases on the scope of individual Second Amendment rights to have guns at its first conference for the new term on September 29th, according to the court's electronic docket. Both petitions challenge a Seventh Circuit ruling that the Second Amendment does not restrict gun control laws adopted by states, county, or city government, but applies only to federal laws. The cases are NRA versus Chicago and McDonald versus Chicago. The so-called incorporation issue is the most significant single issue raised in the wake of the court's 2008 decision in D.C. versus Heller, recognizing for the first time a personal right to have a gun for self-defense, at least in one's home. If the court agrees to hear the new cases after its first look, and that would be announced as early as the day after the conference, that is on Wednesday, September 30th, the first conference of a new term customarily is held in advance of the term's formal opening, and this year that term starts on October 5th. The court has not yet scheduled a time to consider another pending case on the Second Amendment issue, which is Maloney versus Rice. The response in that case is now due on October 28th, which would be tomorrow. The new justice, Sonia Sotomayor, took part in the Maloney case, when she was on the Second Circuit Court. Like the Seventh Circuit, the Second Circuit found that the Second Amendment only applies to federal laws. When the justices consider the Maloney case, Sotomayor is not expected to take part. The fact that she has taken part in a ruling on the issue in one case, however, would not require her to withdraw from consideration in cases from other circuits, like the Chicago cases. So there you go. Additionally, another high-profile gun rights case is inching towards the Supreme Court. Federal Appeals Court on A federal appeals court on September 24th will hear a high-profile gun case that is a leading candidate to end up before the U.S. Supreme Court. The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Anti-Gun Scumbags is likely to decide whether the Second Amendment's guarantee of a right to, quote, keep and bear arms, end quote, restricts only the federal government, the current state of affairs, or whether it can be used to strike down instructive states and local laws as well. I'm sorry, intrusive state and local laws. I should have changed the type style on this so it's easier to read. I'm sorry. The three-judge panel ruled that the Second Amendment does apply to the states, but now a larger Ninth Circuit panel will rehear the case, a procedure reversed only for issues of exceptional importance, which means the earlier decision could be upheld or overruled. Two other circuits have said the Second Amendment does not apply to the states, a legal term known as incorporation. If the Ninth Circuit's en blanc panel continues to agree with its peers, the Supreme Court almost certainly would step in. I actually believe the Supreme Court would step in if the Ninth Circuit keeps its current ruling, because now we've got different circuits around the country saying different things, so the law is not applied equally across the country. The Ninth Circuit case involves Russell and Sally Nordyke, who run a gun show business that would like to rent Alameda County's fairgrounds. The county includes Oakland and is across the bay from San Francisco. After being blocked, they sued. The author of the ordinance in question, then County Supervisor Mary King, actually claims such shows are nothing but, quote, a place for people to display guns for worship as deities and the collectors who treat them as icons of patriotism. End quote. Now, that would be similar as if they denied a permit to a religious group so that they could display things such as Bibles and crosses, with that rationale. The hearing is set for 10 a.m. Pacific time in the federal courthouse at 95 7th Street in San Francisco. Here's a few other items. A California update. Forget about the California update. California's all kinds of screwed up. I don't even really want to get into it. Because California allowed these anti-gun politicians to get into their face and into their business years ago. and they've done nothing about getting them out of there. There are, on the inland portions away from the coast, there's a very large conservative movement within the state. Actually, it's always been that way. Even right around Santa Barbara. Santa Barbara is still halfway conservative. Not entirely, but halfway conservative. But for the most part, if it's on the water, it's liberal. That's just the way it is. But if you actually look at a map of the state and you look at the red and the blue, blue being for Democrats, red being for Republicans, there's more areas that are red than there are blue by far. But the blue areas are so much more densely populated, it negates the rest of the red. So, you know, they've got Schwarzenegger in there as a governor, a rhino, Republican in name only, who really has just succumbed to all the liberal pressures and has signed anti-gun and anti-sportsman legislation onto the books without fighting it whatsoever. So, you know, that gives you an idea of what you're dealing with in California. Great place to visit, not a great place to live, in my opinion, because of the laws, legislating you from cradle to grave. So, here's a little tidbit on Gun Rights 101. This is about the Seattle's Mayor Nichols and D.C.'s Mayor Norton seem to have the same problem where they can't suspend civil rights. Seattle's officially lame duck Mayor Greg Nichols, he's in his last term, and the District of Columbia's delegate for life, Eleanor Holmes Norton. I hate the hyphenated women. Pick a name and stick with it. Eleanor Holmes Norton have something in common that has already gotten one in a lot of trouble, and the other may be asking for some. Both seem to believe that constitutional rights can be suspended. Nichols lost the gun owner vote in Seattle and has now lost his job, coming in third in the primary election just last week, so he's done. Because he spent the last 14 months waging a quiet war on gun rights and Washington State's model preemption statute, he had threatened to ban all firearms, including those legally carried by citizens licensed to pack concealed handguns, not to mention the growth cadre of citizens who carry openly, from city property by executive order, and advised that he lacked the authority. He promised to do it anyway. I'm sorry for the pause there. I'm getting a message from my board operator. It says, hey, I have a hyphenated last name. You know what then? Pick one. Nichol says his jets apparently cooled a little bit. Nichol still has instituted questionable lease requirements for anyone holding an event on city property. They must ban firearms from these events. He's making these organizers his proxy gun ban enforcers, a requirement they have no authority to enforce. The key thing, it's been just bubbling under the surface, is what's going on with President Obama and guns. There's a real question mark, not only for extremists, but for gun rights advocates in the mainstream. Brian Levin, Center for the Study of Hate and Extremism at California State University, says this. Norton of Seattle wants to create a gun-free zone around President Barack Obama and members of his cabinet in the wake of demonstrations around the country at Obama events where protesters openly carried firearms. She was quoted by a Fox News affiliate saying, certainly you don't want to have people around the president openly carrying weapons and saying, I can do this and you can't do anything, you can do nothing about it. Sorry, Norton's from D.C. I said she was from Seattle. So she says, you certainly don't want people around the president openly carrying weapons and saying that. No, certainly you don't. Certainly I do. So don't give me this certainly everybody blanket statement there, Miss something hyphenated Norton, whatever your name is, Holmes Norton. Carrying on. And why not, we ask, about why don't you want to have people openly carrying weapons and saying, I can do this and you can't do anything about it? As we said days ago, no American politician, including the president, should have any apprehension about sitting down with a legally armed citizen or attending a public meeting attended by citizens who are carrying firearms. Just the other day, the Washington Post quoted Brian Levin, director of the Center of the Study for Hate and Extremism at California State University at San Bernardino, who observed the following. A key thing that's been bubbling under the surface is what's going on with President Obama and guns. There's a real question mark, not only for extremists, but for gun rights advocates in the mainstream. Finally, after waiting for so many years, someone in academia has acknowledged that there are gun rights advocates in the mainstream. So why wouldn't de facto President Obama, or any president for that matter, feel comfortable sitting down with a room filled with the mainstream Americans, guns and all, maybe sharing a cold one, to talk about pressing issues of the day? White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs told reporters several days ago that there are laws that govern firearms that are done state or locally. These laws don't change when the president comes to your state or locality. And you're damn right, Robert. Although you're a horrible press secretary. Really, you're bad. You're terrible. The ever-paranoid Paul Helmke, chief alarmist of the Brady campaign, fired back with, "What Gibbs said is wrong. Individuals carrying loaded weapons at these events require constant attention from police and Secret Service officers. It's crazy to bring a gun to these events. It endangers everybody." Well, thank you for the stupid response, Paul. You are an absolute, just fear-creating, hate-mongering scuzz. I guess that's all I have to say to you about that. That's all I got to say about that. More to come after the break. Stay tuned. I'm your host, Bill Carnes, right here on 2A Radio.
You can have the alcohol and tobacco. Leave the firearms to us. Right now, live, the 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes.
All right, folks, I want to go over something about fringe groups here. Bear with me. One of the easier tactics against Americans is to divide Americans. One of Saul Alinsky's urgings was to vex people and alienate against each other, thereby dividing them. Well, more are beginning to feel this. The left in America pushed for acceptance of open-mindedness in the 60s, but when it got its way in divorce law, gun control, education, environment, and thought, it tended to silence others as offensive, hateful, and worse, and created political co-recklessness, a sort of phony etiquette that was censorship in disguise. Fooled again by the left, then coerced and punished by the left, as Americans had a genuine interest in compassion and cooperation, we were completely played by this fringe group. But this cooperation nullified critical thinking, and too many people wound up loathing each other, the short-term goal of the so-called correctness. Americans are divided by ridiculing some who might have warned that the present-day crisis were coming. They called us nuts, control freaks, and fringe groups. Today, among the fringe groups, you have the currency groups who warn of international currency preemption and the loss of our dollar. Pardon me. They urge recognition of real money, the concept of something with inherent value such as gold and silver. And here's a caution. That means independence. It will show up on the social radar as oppositional to what they're trying to do. On discovery, though, Americans really don't seem to agree with what officials are trying to do, and why should they? The Constitution fringe group point out that the electorate are the sovereign, and the servants are, well, there are servants, and they're elected into those positions. Some are appointed into those positions. Some are confirmed into those positions. They are our servants. As real problems arose in 2008 and 2009, warnings of these quote-unquote fringe groups seemed to be coming true, as it had unifying effect on more and more of Americans. It's been put recently as awakening the sleeping giant. There are the food and commodity shortage groups, those observers who see the changes around the globe and understanding their meaning for the United States. The rice shortages there, the corn shortages here, while they are now portified for fuel consumptions more than human consumption from the green movement. The effect of these is to close all alternatives and come under a dependency of attrition for fossil fuels. These affect prices of other commodities as they are diverting different assets, like the corn. It's going to change up. If they were able to find another use for a potato, that's going to partially jack up our economy as well. The sudden need for corn as fuel, coinciding with the refusal of nuclear power as a alternative clean energy, make one example of how crisis is growing to the detriment of the nation. There are the vaccination groups who believe that officials cannot vaccinate and enforce vaccinations without health care law in place first. There are the legal eagle fringe groups who point out that law after law is made possible only because of an earlier law where the end goal was something sneaked in that the people would never have approved of otherwise. Then there's gun control, a division of Americans, a few generations by now. Division is created by more than 20,000 gun laws across the country by misinformed and intentionally negligent media, calling gun owners hate groups and militia types, and as Timothy McVeigh types, and gunslingers, vigilantes, etc. America hasn't even felt this kind of targeting as a totality until around 2008, when non-gun owners began to feel the indignity of abuse of powers the way the gun owners feel it. And we saw that in the skyrocketing of sales of guns and ammunition. There are the New World Order watchdog groups who warn of how significant all of these are and where they're related. There are overall warnings of all so-called fringe groups observers. The idea that all of this comes over all Americans, not just those who spend money, eat food, or defend themselves. These come over Americans imperceptibly, seemingly reasonable at first, but only too late to do anything about it. America was warned by the fringe groups, and now the people who create us and look at us as fringe groups have become a fringe group of their own. Really, a victim of their own design. Gun owners are no longer a fringe group. We are the mainstream. We are America. Even though I personally disagree, I should say I professionally disagree, with some of the ways the NRA represents gun owners, such as sportsmen and hunters, and not ever as defense, hardly ever as a defense, it's still incumbent upon gun owners to spend the $30, $35, $40 a year to be a member of the NRA, so they have a more powerful lobby, so we do not lose our rights, and it shows the courts how strong American gun ownership is. So if you haven't joined already, please consider it. More after the break. Stay tuned. I'll be back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Bill Carnes, 1-800-313-9443.
How many of you living out there in different states have a castle doctrine on the books? Or a group of laws that, in effect, create a castle doctrine? Nevada doesn't have a castle doctrine per se, but it has laws on the books that would otherwise put one into effect. Now, castle doctrine means you're in your house, you own it, somebody comes in with ill intent, and they're bringing a fight to you in your home. Well, that secures your right from prosecution and from lawsuit, from civil lawsuit, to shoot them. Somebody breaks into your house. They kick down the door, bust in the window, come in the backsliding window, break through that, pardon me, and bring a home invasion right to your face. Shoot them. And in a castle doctrine, you're cleared on that criminally, as long as it meets the elements. And you're also secured from civil prosecution. Now, it's interesting, there are several states that have the castle doctrine, but you wouldn't want to do it because there's so many laws that really kind of challenge the castle doctrine. California's a perfect example. They have a castle doctrine, but you would never know it because there's all other kinds of laws that otherwise get in the way of the castle doctrine. One of the real problems I have with the legislative process is when they want to pass a new law, they don't necessarily ever go over any old laws and look at them. All right? California's a perfect example. California, let's just take one small aspect. And I may have said this on the air before. One small aspect of law. Let's just talk about the laws dealing with landlord and tenants. Landlord-tenant acts, right? How landlords and tenants need to abide by each other, just on the state level. This doesn't include anything county or civil. There are more laws on landlord-tenant, more words in law on landlord-tenant in the state of California than all laws in the entire state of Nevada. And that includes everything. Every law written in the entire state of Nevada, we're talking at the state level, have less words than merely landlord-tenant law in California. There was a guy in California, this is probably 15 years ago, who was a bailiff that stopped paying rent at his apartment. And he knew a lot of attorneys being a bailiff, and he was doing an experiment. How long could he stay in his apartment without paying rent and continuously dodge the eviction process? The answer is 26 months, over 2 years. Because every time the management of the apartment complex would go to evict him, he could find a contradictory law or have one of his scumbag attorney friends who supported this guy living for free. When he had the money to do it, he was just running his own experiment at the expense of the apartment complex owners and their management. Imagine how many people may have lost their jobs because they couldn't evict this guy. And the owners didn't want to hear any excuses. So why we want this guy gone. He hasn't paid his rent in 6 to 8 months, whatever it is. 26 months, scumbag. If you're that bailiff or former bailiff and you're listening, you're a scumbag. You really are. If you didn't like living there, move out. If you're going to live there, pay him what you owe him. Don't be a scumbag. Anyhow. If you have the castle doctrine on your books, I want to get calls and emails and let me know which states you live in and which ones have the castle doctrine. Because there happens to be some debate over some different people that broke into a home. Let me read to you a little bit. This is coming out of Charlotte, North Carolina. Police say a 76-year-old C.L. McCure shot and killed a 15-year-old named Marcus Fluker this last Saturday afternoon after Fluker and several other teenagers broke into McClure's home, tied him up, robbed him and his wife at gunpoint. Police said McClure freed himself, got in his car, then drove out in search of the suspects. He found them at a nearby apartment complex and fired several times, hitting Fluker. The teen was pronounced dead at Carolina's Medical Center. Police referred all questions to the Mecklenburg County District Attorney's Office, but prosecutors said Monday they haven't gotten the case yet. I'm guessing it'll be a couple of weeks before they bring it over, says Prosecutor Marcia McNaud on Monday, refusing to comment further on the case. But it's already a topic of discussion around the Mecklenburg County Courthouse and the legal community. The real question for the district attorney is whether this is a case of vigilante. Pardon me. Why can't I say vigilante? Why am I so tongue-tied today? You know, I didn't have my I did not have my my morning drink today. I didn't have it. I did not make my smoothie, and it's really messing me up. I'll make sure to have my smoothie tomorrow morning. The real question for the district attorney is whether this case, this was a case of vigilante justice. It may have been, said Tom Shearer, a former prosecutor who is now a defense attorney in Charlotte. Shearer said police and soon prosecutors will have access to critical information that may not be public yet, and they will have to use that to make their decisions. He may still have a self-defense claim, and McClure's neighbors also discussed the case on Monday. They said, right then and there, he was not even thinking. He was just, you could have come killed my wife or anything else like that, said Mary Fritz. Fritz said she understands why McClure would go to such lengths, but neighbor Tanya Calhoun said she's not convinced it was the right thing to do. But you can't do that. What if the little boy wasn't one of the boys in the house, she asked. Well, I guess you weren't there to know. Here's the deal. This is kind of a touchy subject. If the kids were still in the house, and McClure was able to grab his gun and shoot him while they were there, case closed. But he actually went out, drove around looking for him, and then shot him. So this sends the following information. Was he in fear of death or serious bodily injury while he was tied up? Did anybody receive death or serious bodily injury while they were tied up? Were they threatened with death or serious bodily injury while they were tied up? If the answers to those are yes, if somebody told them, look, we're going to beat your ass, we're going to kill your wife, you know, whatever. If they were told that and they believed it, and then they left, in the eyes of the police, if you're a cop, you have the authority to stop them if they present an imminent threat to anybody else in the community if they escape. So you can shoot them to stop them. If this was under the same guise of that, then I can see that McClure actually acted legally. If he was under the belief, the articulable belief, that he and or his wife were under threat from imminent death or serious bodily injury by these kids, these felons, and they also believed that if they got away, that they would be a continued threat to the rest of the community, then they were acting under the same rules that police act under, and you could go after it. You know, even just avoiding that whole thing. Did these kids deserve what they got? That's kind of a touchy subject, too. They deserve something. Not so sure they deserve to get shot and killed. However, you're 15 years old, you're involved in a group, you're going in, you're breaking into somebody's house. You're breaking into the house of senior citizens who have been senior citizens for over a decade. Tie them up and rob them at gunpoint. Let me tell you, you don't deserve a silver platter. I'll tell you that much. If nothing else, you deserve to have your ass whipped. Now, my idea of cruel and unusual punishment is vastly different than that of the ACLU's. I'm really into the whole Singapore idea of you should cane somebody's ass several times. And that punk back in the early 90s that was sentenced to getting caned six times, and we got it reduced down to three smacks and then brought him home, forget all that. They should have let him smack the kid six times and then probably soothe his wounds with some salty lemon juice. That's my opinion. Don't get in the way. I mean, caning, I don't believe, is cruel and unusual. What they look at is, well, what's it going to do to the person who's doing the caning? That could make them really messed up and give them psychological issues. You know what? There's people out there that are already born that way. Recruit them for the job. All right? People that are a little sadistic, they're either going to go out there and they're going to harm people illegally, or you give them a job to whack people with a cane, and they get it out of their system, and then they are otherwise productive members of society. Recruit those guys. The CIA does. Maybe we could get some of the retired CIA guys, or maybe this could be training to go into the CIA for the interrogation program. smack these guys with a stick. No different than getting a switch off a tree. It's just a little bit different switch, and the person who's whipping you is getting paid to do it. That's what I'm talking about right there. That's exactly what I'm talking about. So anyhow, McClure goes out, and you know, he fires downrange a bit and hits 15-year-old Marcus Fluker, who was one of the kids who broke into his home, tied up and robbed he and his wife at gunpoint. I believe, now, we're not talking in a legal sense, but I believe that McClure was morally justified in doing what he did. My belief, he had the moral justification, regardless of what the laws are or are not, and how this case shakes out, which, if I continue to get updates on this, I'll continue to update you on this. Regardless of how it shakes out, that was moral fiber on the part of C.L. McClure, the 76-year-old guy that went out and hunted these kids down. I call them kids. I should say hunted these felons down. The age really shouldn't matter. I believe he had moral fiber in that, and I believe that, he was morally just in that. Now, many people are going to disagree with me. I'm destined to get emails on this. And the interesting thing is, I'm destined to get emails of support on my position on this, is the type of emails I'm sure to get. I will probably get other people saying, well, you know, maybe look at it like this, that, and the other. I got to tell you, by the way, you as the audience out there for RBN, the Republic Broadcasting audience, is the most intelligent audience I've ever broadcast to. Very, very well informed. And, I mean, as a fringe group, you guys rock, I got to tell you. Going back to the story in a couple segments back. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about how to handle things. Somebody breaks into your house. First of all, we've talked before about training physically. We've talked about training mentally. Are you prepared if somebody breaks into your house? Because I got to tell you right now, home invasions where people are doing this are becoming much, much more bold. It used to be always in the middle of the night. You remember back in the 80s, Richard Ramirez, the night stalker in LA, breaking in at night. Well, people oftentimes now are breaking in during the daytime. You know, it's funny. I'm going to talk about the night for just a moment because, like, I have kids. And, you know, sometimes you have kids and they're afraid of the dark. I am so comfortable in the dark because I know that if I'm going anywhere in the dark, especially in my hometown, or, you know, the town I live, I should say, my house, I am intimately familiar with the places that I go. And in the dark, I have the advantage. You know the difference between cover and concealment. Cover will stop bullets. Concealment does not. Nighttime, without the presence of artificial light, is constant concealment all around you. That's why I feel comfortable at night. If someone were to break into my home, I know my home a lot better than anybody else. Much better. So bring it on. Because I know where I'm going and what I'm doing. I have a plan. And my plan is vested in experience in that particular physical setting. And you don't. You're at a handicap. I don't care if you've been in my house 20 times. You are at a handicap to me just by the knowledge of it. Being a bit of a gambling man, I'm going to lay down my bets. You're at a bit of a disadvantage when it comes to ability, technique, and preparedness as well. If you break into my house and try to bring the fight to me, there's going to be several other disadvantages coming your way. Now, I don't underestimate my opponents. Trust me. That is a huge and fatal, oftentimes, mistake. But I do have to say that the preparedness that I have done for anybody doing that in my house is probably well beyond what most people would ever consider trying to bring to my house. So, again, oftentimes, these home invasions are now happening quite brazenly during the daytime. And it's not always in poor neighborhoods. They're sometimes adjacent to poor neighborhoods, and other times they're in good, affluent neighborhoods, middle American neighborhoods as well, because the bad part of town, the people that reside there, are mobile. They know where the good side of town is. Now, if you have the opportunity, if you're going to go and you're going to rob a store, and you have the opportunity to choose between, you know, a 99-cent store, I shouldn't even say that. I should say a second-hand store, or a high-end furniture store that sells a lot of furniture. Which one do you think is going to have more money in there? Well, I would probably go after the furniture store, unless I was just looking for ease. But the thing is, what I'm saying is, if you've got to drive to the furniture store, if it's further away, then that's fine. The bad guys know this. They know if they want to get more stuff, more money, more valuables, then they have to leave the more derelict area of town, oftentimes, which they're from. Because you're not going to get much from people that don't have much. So you'll travel, even in broad daylight, to the areas where people will have more, and they become your victims. Unless you are that intended victim, and you listen to this show, you heed my words, and you blow holes in these people as soon as they bust in your door. That's the exception to the rule. Somebody busts in your door, and they bring the fight to you. You aerate the SOBs and turn them into a human-esque version of Swiss cheese by blasting them with a shotgun, a handgun, a rifle, whatever you've got, whatever is your house gun, whatever you've trained with. Ends the problem. No more future problems from this guy. Stay tuned, guys. I'll be right back.
Your right to listen and take action shall not be infringed. The 2A Radio Show with Bill Carnes is back. 1-800-313-9443.
All right, folks, I mentioned it early on. I'm going to spend a little bit of time now doing this. I'm involved with a group, a very tight-knit group, a small group, that is going to put together a training opportunity here in the Las Vegas area out of the Clark County Shooting Park, which is bound to be wonderful. As a matter of fact, one of the principal guys involved, one of the other guys, is knows, pardon me, the manager out at the Clark County Shooting Park. They've met. They're on a first-name basis. So he's able to, I don't want to say schmooze that relationship. That's not where I'm going. So what I'm saying is he's able to get direct information on how things need to be set up for a smooth transition into training out there at this particular facility, which will be the largest and the nicest shooting facility in the world. That's as it's being built. And we'll be training, we'll be teaching classes out there. We'll be doing some training. So I'm the guy that handles curriculum. I'm the guy that will actually be writing the majority of the courses on this. One of the other guys will be doing a lot of the non-gun related stuff, or some of the impact related stuff when it comes to guns. That's really his forte, with more of a martial arts background. So my question to you is, what type of courses would you like to see? Obviously, we're talking handgun, shotgun, rifle. That's not what I want to hear. What I'm talking about is really the length of course, because we have a couple of opportunities to create certain courses for the local populace that would be a little bit more appeasing to their schedules on weekends and such. But I'm interested in knowing about the people that would be traveling in. What would be a better way to market towards you? Would you like to see classes that are a Monday through Thursday and capitalize on the Sunday through Thursday rates in Las Vegas? Something like that? Or would you rather not miss those days of work and have more weekend-related things so you can spend a weekend in Vegas? Really, what are you guys looking for? There, I might get an equal amount of each. I mean, maybe we would do some early week classes. It might be Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, so you could take care of the Sunday through Thursday rates. Maybe we would do Friday, Saturday, Sunday classes, or Saturday, Sunday classes to take advantage of being in Vegas all weekend. Really, send me some of your thoughts and comments on that. Because when we put a schedule together and we put it out there, we want to appease you, the people that are coming out. We're already looking at some very nice cooperative-related things, such as hotel packages and things such as that if you come out to train. So shoot me some feedback. You can go to 2aradio.com, get my email address, which is bill@2aradio.com, and send me some of your thoughts and what would appease you in coming out here. Now, keep in mind, this is going to be very high-end, very specialized training. So it's going to be exactly what you're looking for in a defensive nature. I'd like to close by saying, to those of you within our government, we will be watching you. In Congress, the executive and judicial branches all very closely as we organize to save our freedom, liberty, and country. We will not become the subjects of governmental rule.
Bill will be here tomorrow. Will your freedoms? The 2A Radio Show, 7 a.m. Pacific, 9 Central, Monday through Friday.